And welcome to a Saturday night. The chair is warm from Dr. David Viscott, who spent the last 3 hours doing it to you and all of us again. How wonderful. Hope you got his new book. His new book is something else, The Viscott Method. But we have a method for you tonight. It's a method of how to enlighten you, bring you some astounding information that perhaps you don't know anything about, bring you up to date on some information we've talked about before. We'll be a bit scientific tonight, but we have one of the greatest scientists in the country, I think. He's a scientist, but he has a way of talking about very scientific things in a very earthy way that you and I can, well, if I can understand him, I figure you can understand him. His name is Tom Bearden. Tom has been deeply involved in the research of many of our weapon systems, our computer systems for doing all their maneuvers so we don't have to send all the armies out to sea. He knows exactly what's going on in the world of science. Tom, welcome aboard. Are you there, Tom? Tom?
Yes, I said, thank you, Bill. It's a pleasure to be back.
Well, I didn't have you turned on.
Okay.
I was glad to have you there. Tom has electrified this audience over the last few years that we've been doing it on the Open Mind Show. I suppose, Tom, that I get more mail about you and more requests for you to come on than anyone else that we've had, and we've had some really good ringers in here.
And well, I certainly appreciate that, Bill, and I certainly appreciate the audience writing those letters.
They have written the letters. You've electrified us about free energy devices, about the scalar interferometers. You have another thing on your mind tonight. Let's get scientific. What's happening with the weather? Is it being manipulated? Is it being controlled? Or is this nature doing its thing all by itself?
Well, in my opinion, it's being strongly influenced by outside devices and outside means, particularly the weather over North America itself.
Let's get into that, because it's affected a lot of people. Lives have been lost here in the United States of America.
Okay, let me, to get into the thing and exactly how it's being done, and before I get through tonight, I want to give the audience some things they can look for in the sky and see. I will give them some very specific signatures that they can see for themselves when this is being done. And if you see these particular signatures in the sky, you can rest assured you're looking at weather engineering that's being done from far around the world, probably from the Soviet Union.
I would suggest, Tom, if I may break here in just a second, that this is an important broadcast. I think it's a very important broadcast. And if you have a tape recorder handy, I would like for you to get your tape recorders rolling. And if you have a friend, I think you should call them and have them listen in, because you're going to hear something tonight that will astound you. And we're rolling tapes here, Tom, but go right ahead.
Okay, to start with, I'm going to have to give you just a little preparation so that you understand in a way what's being done and how it can be done. So let me start out with the very basic thing of what a scalar wave is. If you take two ordinary waves and you put them together 180 degrees out from each other, what you can result from that, what you can have when you get through with that, you can have a wave or a pulse in space-time itself. What you do is you squeeze space-time just like you'd squeeze a sponge rhythmically, but you do not create the normal kind of electric field and magnetic field in the wave that we normally have in our textbooks. If you do it correctly, you don't have to add just two waves. You could add 10. The thing is, as long as the vectors sum to zero, very precisely, you have created a zero vector wave, and that makes it a scalar wave.
Now, a vector wave, Tom,
for simple purposes, just look at it as if you were rhythmically squeezing a sponge and unsqueezing it. And what you're doing that to is space-time itself with this kind of wave. That's what it does. Now, that is really the original way that Tesla discovered back shortly before the turn of the century in his Colorado experiments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this kind of a wave can be easily made in the laboratory and it can be proven to exist, and you can use it. But I want to tell you a couple of things you can do with it. If I take something like a pencil beam radar, something that transmits a very narrow beam, and if I cross two of these beams, that is, two of these scalar beams, not the normal beam that you make from a normal radar, but this particular kind of beam, in the little area where they cross, the interference produces ordinary energy, ordinary electromagnetic waves. You can stick something in there and you can certainly detect that. It looks like the normal stuff. The difference in this interference pattern is that we are now putting in the zeros and creating the non-zeros in the middle. The way we look at it with normal wave interference is we put in the energy and the out-of-phase interference can create the destructive zones or the zeros. We do it just backwards here. We put in the zeros, and in the middle, in this interference zone, we create the ordinary energy. So what we're saying is, with this kind of a wave, which a normal detector will not detect, you can stick an antenna right up in the middle of it if you've got a good one, and you will not see a detection on your oscilloscope. But in the interference pattern, which may be 1,000 miles away or even 10,000 miles away, in that narrow area where they cross, or you can make wider beams and have a wider area, you will produce ordinary energy, ordinary electromagnetic interference zones. Now, that really is the secret of Tesla's wireless transmission of energy at a distance. Because everything you put in on the other end comes out in that interference zone. You don't lose a single bit of it. There is no square loss involved in this process. Now,
no transmission cost whatsoever.
No loss in the transmission at all. You get all of it out on the other end that you put in on this end. If you put 2 kilowatts in this end, in the interference zone out there, you have 2 kilowatts of energy.
But the power companies don't like that, Tom. They like to sell transmission of energy.
Well, it's true. We've just told you how to do it without the losses that occur in the lines. And, of course, that was Tesla's wireless transmission without energy. He is the one that really discovered how to do that.
You know something that I have found out, Tom? I want to keep everybody up to date. We've been talking about Tesla here. I have found out that a lot of people, when I talk to, I mention Nikola Tesla, they don't know who I'm talking about.
Well, that's true, and it's not accidental. Nikola Tesla, of course, given a thumbnail sketch here, is the man who almost single-handedly gave us the electrical 20th century. He gave us the multi-phase power system, the AC power system we use today.
The alternating current. Right?
The alternating current. He gave us the rotating field that made our motors and generators possible. He invented the radio, not Marconi, which all the books have in it. The Supreme Court, 1943, overthrew the Marconi patents. And, of course, Tesla... It was a Tesla apparatus that Marconi used to do his experiment.
So our radio station is operating off of a Tesla apparatus.
Here. That's correct. He also built the first guided automatons. You know, he had a guided boat that he showed and demonstrated, guiding it radio controlled. And he anticipated intercontinental ballistic missiles. He also, at his death, had a paper that described a particle beam weapon, for example, which would have worked. And he had, of course, discovered a more fundamental electromagnetic wave than we've been using in our theory today.
Which is what you call the scalar
wave. What I'm calling the scalar wave.
He also had the death ray, and he demonstrated it.
Yes. Now, my purpose here is to show that this kind of a wave can be used to do some things like influence the weather over an entire hemisphere. Okay, the way you would do this is as follows. Suppose I had two or more transmitters which were producing beams of the scalar wave energy I'm talking about, which the beams cross over North America. They all converge and cross over the United States and Canada. Okay, in the interference zone, you would see what looks like a standard wave interference pattern. You would see rows of waves crossing other rows of waves. Now, as a matter of fact, that exact pattern a friend of mine and I have seen here over Huntsville, Alabama, running from north to south as far as the eye could see, the clouds were divided into absolutely even rows, as if you had a plowed field in the sky. And if you turned at right angles and looked in the other direction, from horizon to horizon, you had another series of what looked like absolutely even cloud rows.
I have a series of photographs of that cloud structure over Los Angeles of last week.
Good. Now, if that's the formation of the thing. Now, this particular phase of the weather intervention over North America started, they started adjusting this stuff in shortly before the death of Brezhnev. Now, the signatures of adjusting it in are as follows. What you will get when you're starting to deposit and pop out energy here and there, all over, at certain nodal points where you get pretty good pop out, dump of energy, you will get low-level atmospheric booms. Not the big booms, but the low-level little micro booms. And you had those going in Alabama. You had them going down in Florida and off the coast of Florida. And at various spots throughout the country, you had these things going. And reported in various articles in the paper. That's what it was. You were having dumps, sudden little cracks or dumps of energy into the atmosphere, which are making these popping sounds. The other thing that you can have them doing is you can have them being dumped into the ground, and so you can have a series of little microquakes, particularly when they're in areas where you normally don't get those things. Now, on the microquakes in the ground, you will pick them up with a seismograph. They won't look all that much different from the small microquakes that you get in nature anyway, but the micro airquakes will be significant. Now, they apparently took about 3 months or so to adjust this whole network in and get it all set and working right to their satisfaction. And then I'm convinced personally, it's my personal opinion, and I'm convinced that they are responsible to a great degree for giving us our beautiful floods that we had in the early spring of 1983 that caused a lot of flood damage here and there everywhere.
When you say they, you are speaking of the Soviets.
I'm talking about the Russians. This is a Russian weapon, and it's coming from Russia, and is being used on us over North America, in my opinion.
This is not to be confused with a ELF transmitter.
No, sir. This is not ELF. Now, understand, if you want to disguise the thing, you can put a little ELF in it, ordinary stuff that you can pick up, and you'll think you're looking at the Russian woodpecker, and you won't know about the other stuff. Now, it turns out that water vapor, or water in the air, which is not really vapor, it's in droplet form, where they tell us it forms around a little particle of dust. You have a water drop, and if you're high enough in the atmosphere, of course, it freezes. You have a little particle of ice around the dust drop. But these little particles of water or particles of ice in the atmosphere are very interactive with this scalar wave stuff. They act as little interferometers, and they do react to the scalar wave stuff. And so the water itself in the air, in the form of clouds, does move and form patterns when very strong scalar wave engineering is being done, or energy of this nature is being created in that region, when you have the interference pattern. Okay, the first thing we did, we had an actual sighting, a friend of mine and I, over Huntsville. We saw this grid pattern actually being adjusted in, and it persisted in the sky for over half a day. Now, that's a peg point for number one. That fit very well in a time frame with the after the spring floods and all, getting ready for adjustment in the winter weather. Okay. After they got it adjusted and gave us the floods, the way that you can swing a cloud mass is once I have it adjusted in over an area, if I now turn my transmitter slowly, and I can turn them in any pattern I figure out to do, it's as if I move slowly that whole grid pattern. I can, and with phasing, I can make parts of it move. And so I can do things like reaching up and capturing the pressure areas and moving the jet stream itself down so that the classic pattern emerges. What we had in all this bad weather, we had this big jet stream dip very far down, coming in over from California, coming in over Texas and all, and then roaring up along the ridge back of the northeast, and so it roared through the south and on up parallel to the eastern coast. And we had storm after storm after storm roar through with that pattern along the bent and deviated jet streams of the upper atmosphere. California, for example, if you established a few blocking patterns, you had storms which came and hammered at the coast and hammered and hammered and hammered. coming the same way. So that gave California a good show. Now, another pattern that you will find forming, and let's see, I'll have to give you a visualization here to get a hold of what I'm talking about. I want you to imagine now a checkerboard where we've laid everything off in little squares. Now, in the center of, that's the wave diffraction pattern sitting up in the sky over North America. In the center of each little square, we're creating ordinary energy. You can put a detector in there, you can detect it. And by the way, the underground net went bananas in the United States. People were calling me from all over with the ELF and other kinds of frequencies they were picking up. And in fact, what they thought was the U.S. government was doing this. And I told them that was nonsense. The government had not built a bunch of transmitters all over the U.S.
Explain, whenever you say underground net, Tom.
The people who are a little bit off the orthodox pattern track and who do measurements out in the field and measure the Soviet woodpecker signals and measure what kind of signals out there and who's trying to do what to who.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to make some sense out of it and trying to put it together and find out what's going on.
Private citizens.
Private citizens.
Connected.
Yeah. And they picked up these this energy, which is in the form of frequencies in the middle of each one of these grid zones. They picked that up all over the country. And so they thought that somebody had built an enormous number of transmitters throughout the U.S., but that's not the case. But it gives you the same effect as if the Russians had been permitted to come into the United States, as if they had built a transmitter in the center of each one of these little grid zones. In other words, I've been calling that a virtual transmitter. The reason is, you have ordinary energy there, just like comes out of any ordinary transmitter. You can measure it, you can detect it, and it has real effects. And so we had that sitting all over the United States. Now, the next thing that to visualize in each little square, visualize now a little mountaintop sticking up, and that's your energy sitting in that square. So what you're looking at on the checkerboard now is all of these squares with all of these little mountaintops, these little almost triangular-shaped things or cone-shaped things sitting all over it. So you're looking at a whole bunch of little cone-shaped things sitting all over North America, and that represents the energy sitting in each grid. Okay, around each one of those cones, depending on how they're transmitting, the clouds will react. There are two kinds of reactions that will occur, and you can look up in the sky for yourself, and if you're lucky, you'll see one of these patterns. I've seen about seven so far. I've been successful in photographing one. I finally had a camera with me when another one appeared over Huntsville, and I got that one's picture. But the signature to look for, the first one, is around where the cone of energy is, the clouds will form about two-thirds of a circle, about 5 miles in diameter. A little thin line of clouds will form this very unusual, almost circle, about two-thirds of a circle. And then radially, straight away from where the center would be, there will be long, thin lines of clouds running 15 or 20 miles. And you're looking at something that looks like almost like the old rising sun symbol of Japan in World War II. Only a piece of it is missing. You're looking at maybe a half or two-thirds of a circle with these radials running directly away. These long, thin lines, very straight, of clouds. Very unusual formation.
Going out in all directions from this little...
Radially from the support would be the center of that little two-thirds of a circle. Okay, mm-hmm. Now, when you see that, that is not a natural formation. Now, if you've looked at the sky very much, you realize that clouds do form striated clouds. That's a well-known type of cloud. There are many types of striated clouds. We are not talking about those normal striated clouds at all. This is very abnormal. You can't mistake it once you ever see it. That's the first pattern. What I call the giant radial. It's just a circle, almost circle, about 5 miles in diameter, very thin line of clouds making about two-thirds of a circle. Then radially away from that, straight lines, very straight and very long, 15 or 20 miles long, radiating away from what would be the center of that circle, straight away in the radial direction. Now, if the energy is even stronger, what you'll have is the energy will spill out past the checkerboard border in one of these where you're putting the interference in, and between two of these conical places or two of the things that are forming the giant radials, two of them will get together. When that happens, the inner circle will disappear. And so you have the same pattern you just had with a giant radial coming out, and on the other end of it, there is another giant radial pointing back into a center. Only the circle in the center is now missing. In this case, the line of clouds is just a little bit fatter. It's about three times as thick as the other line of clouds. And now you're looking at two of them, which will be anywhere from 20 to 30, even 40 miles apart, which will be moving along in the sky. The one I saw was moving, as best I could estimate it, about 25 miles an hour. And what you're looking at is you're looking at a part of the grid where the energy is being formed, and you're looking at a very, very slow rotation of this occurring by movements on the transmitters coming from Russia. And what we're doing with that is we're capturing entire cloud masses and moving them right along to control the weather. And we're, of course, changing the pressure in the air, and we can do weather engineering that way. Now, I took off from a trip to California. I took off from Huntington Beach, and I had to leave very early to catch the airplane. This was in December, and it was prior to that extreme cold snap we had that broke so many records in the country. As I left Huntington Beach, there was a giant radial sitting right over Huntington Beach. As I got on the airplane then, finally, and came on out to coming into Memphis, when I was about 400 miles from Memphis on a United flight, sitting up at about 30,000 feet was an absolutely flawlessly perfect giant radial. I flew right over it. We were up at about 35,000. And so I was about 5,000 feet above this thing, looking right out at it, an absolutely perfect specimen, and I didn't have a camera with me. But anyway, on the same trip, I saw two of them very far apart in the United States, one halfway across the United States from the other. I've seen three or four here over Huntsville, Alabama, and I saw one in Florida in October on a trip with another person there. We saw a giant radial sitting off down in Florida. The next morning, we saw one in southern Alabama, which preceded quite a bit of violent thunderstorm activity, including some tornado activity in South Alabama. If you twist the weather currents around, you're going to get some tornadoes in the right season. So you can augment the tornado activity. You can augment the rain activity. You can move great masses of clouds, great cloud banks, over great cloud covers over a large part of the United States. And you can actually change the jet stream itself and change the pressure areas. And then by very slow rotation, so that you don't slip out and lose the stuff you're capturing halfway around the world, you can move those cloud masses and influence the weather substantially. And in my opinion, that's been going on over our head, certainly since shortly after the death of Brezhnev. There was considerable activity with giant radials and the virtual transmitters and the grid network shortly before that very, very unusual cold snap, which broke so many records in so many cities all across the country. 1983 was a very unusual weather year. Certain records were really broken. For example, I don't have all my information collated together just yet, but I can give you a few things. One of the things was the highest barometric pressure ever recorded was recorded in 1983. Another thing that happened that was unusual, of course, was the coal records in quite a few cities, some 75 or 100 of them, were broken. All-time records were broken in that December cold snap we had. Let's see, another thing that was very unusual, the turbulence or the amount of swirling of the air in the atmosphere was some 10% or so, 8 to 10% higher, according to the Weather Service, than has been noted. And so we had some very unusual things occur, some very unusual extremes occur in the year 1983, closely correlated with this very unusual activity of adjusting in over North America a gigantic grid of virtual transmitters which can be used to control the weather. So, in my opinion, what I'm describing to you is the evidence, admittedly somewhat circumstantial at this point, But certainly the giant radials can be photographed. I now have photographs of one. The grids can be photographed, and certainly they can be observed. I'm encouraging everybody to start observing the clouds and look for those formations. If you see those formations, let somebody know. Let me know the sighting that you've seen them. Draw a sketch. If you've got a photo camera, take a photograph. If you can't let me know, let Bill Jenkins know.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I'd like everybody to load their camera, get it ready, keep your eye in the sky, take a picture of it, note what time it was taken, or if you don't have a camera, at least write me and say, I saw it here and I saw it there. Get it to me, and I'll get it on to you, Tom. Because I have seen, myself, those circles and the radials going out for them, not knowing about this sort of thing. I said, isn't that odd? But we do have them over Los Angeles.
Now, they're real clever over California. The one in Huntington Beach that morning, they had just cut the power out of it, and it was beginning to dissipate. But because I was out so early, I was out just after the crack of dawn, I got to see the thing. But an hour later, if you'd looked at the sky, if you hadn't known that there'd been a real solid one there, you know, you'd have said, well, there's just a very unusual shaped cloud, set of clouds sitting up there. Because it was dissipating from the winds aloft after the power had been cut. Now, the other thing I'd like to point out is everything I'm describing is directly related to the work of Wilhelm Reich.
Yes.
The Cloudbuster and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
What a Cloudbuster puts out is a peculiar kind of radiation, which is really what I've been calling the zero vector radiation or the scalar radiation. And what it's causing is a peculiar kind of resonance between the scalar currents in the ground and the scalar currents in the atmosphere. And as William Reich clearly showed, and other people who have showed after him have shown with Cloudbusters, you can, for example, influence with that simple device and that kind of resonance. You can influence gigantic masses of clouds, and you can shape the weather. And you can also do it by the transmitters I'm discussing here, and you can do it halfway around the world, which is what I think is being done to us. So anyway, that's a sort of a cook's tour, a short tour through the weather engineering over North America. I am going to give a paper on this summer at one of the conferences, and the paper will be published and available from John Ratzlaff as soon as I get the time to finish writing it. I'm gathering the rest of the data for it now, and I will print the pictures in there of the giant radial that I took here over Huntsville. And if I'm lucky, or if somebody else sends me one, we'll have other pictures of these giant radials as well.
Well, we hope everybody gets their camera out and starts looking for those, and we'll describe those again. Tom, do you want to take a break with me for just a second? We'll do a couple of things and get right back to weather engineering, which is going on above our heads at the present time by our dear friends the Soviets. Be right. One of our distinguished scientists in this world has been involved with the weapons analysis of the Soviet Union for the Pentagon. He's been involved in developing some of our more formidable weapons systems here in the United States. He's a man who knows exactly what he's talking about. And he kind of riveted us here, Tom. You hear for the last 40 minutes talking about the manipulation of weather over the United States by the Soviet Union. He told us some things to look for where you can see it happening yourself. And certainly we've been feeling it here in California. You've been feeling it there in Alabama where you're talking to us from tonight. And it's getting to be a serious problem.
Yes, it is. And until we, you know, bring this thing out strongly enough that we have enough people seeing it, photographing it, the idea here is if we get enough people reporting what's happening in the sky, you'll get the regular scientists in looking at it, and you'll get the government looking at it, and they'll realize that something unusual is going on.
The government is not looking at it right now, you're telling me?
Well, as far as I know, not much of the government, let's say, is looking at it. Not nearly enough.
Why is that, Tom?
Well, it's understandable. The things I'm talking about here, the scalar wave, for example, is not in the present scientific theory. At best, what I'm talking about would be regarded as highly controversial.
Exotic. Now,
if we can move it close enough to where we get it into the highly controversial area, where it's accepted but highly controversial, and by the way, we're doing some very strong things to try to get it to that point. At that point, then, you'll find a lot of normal, orthodox scientific agencies will begin looking at it. The moment they do that, the moment we get the sharp young graduate students and the sharp professors in our major universities looking at this thing, at that moment, we're going to make an awful lot of progress real fast. And that's what we've got to get happening. We've got to get them turned on to it. And we've got to get them doing the phenomenology experiments. There are thousands and thousands of phenomenology experiments that have to be done before we'll fully understand this area. Only a few of those have been done at the present time.
How many transmitters do the Soviets have that are doing this, do you think?
I wish I knew. If I had to estimate, you know, I'd estimate somewhere like a dozen.
That's
purely a guesstimate. It could be many more than that, or it could even be fewer.
They have to use an enormous amount of energy. Where are they getting it?
Okay, there's two sources of the energy, of course. If you look at normal sources, you could get it from a power plant. You could tie your local hydroelectric power plant. The Soviets are pretty good at magnetohydrodynamics, and at least in some of their literature, they have shown that they've had entire power plants run by magnetohydrodynamics that have been tied up to transmitters. For example, in some of the translated Russian papers I was looking at, they have admitted transmitting something like 18 or 20,000 amperes through the entire crust of the Earth. And so we know that in that kind of transmission, they're using very, very powerful transmitters.
Well, they use extremely powerful ones up around Riga. Those are the ELF transmitters.
Yes. Now, the things that we've been calling the woodpecker signal, and the woodpecker name, as you know, Bill, comes from just the sound that the chirp signal makes when you detect it. It sounds nothing like nothing more than a woodpecker's bill hitting a block of wood. And so it was promptly dubbed the woodpecker signal because of that rapid chirp, rapid drumming noise that it makes. Those transmitters, I've seen various estimates on how powerful they are. Some of the estimates run up as high as 100 megawatts. Some even estimate a little higher than that. But whatever they are, they're extremely powerful transmitters. The other thing is, the thing that we're detecting from them is only the normal component. Now, when you use a lot of power in something like that, there's an efficiency with which you would get scalar waves. In other words, you wouldn't get 100% pure scalar waves. You'd get a lot of noise, a lot of spillover, and the other stuff. Now, that part of it, I think, it's like what's above the water we can detect, but what's below the water we can't see. The majority of the stuff that they're transmitting is below the water, so to speak. It's in the scalar range, and our normal detectors don't detect that. Now, since we're on this subject, and since I know that some people in the audience who are listening to me are technical folks, I want to say one other thing just for the technical folks, and I'll be very brief. I want to tell them how to build an extremely sensitive scalar wave detector. The way you do that is you use the very strongest magnet that can be made. Use a superconducting magnet. Make yourself a fuel that's 30 or 40,000 Gauss. Understand, a strong magnet is about 12,000 Gauss, a very strong one. And I'm talking about making an extremely strong field. In that pole or in that field, you have a warp in space-time. And it's strong enough that a scalar wave, if you look at that as a longitudinal vector, to the space-time background, it appears to have a lateral component. What that all means is if you stick a normal wire in there and hook it up to a resonant circuit with an oscilloscope, you can detect the scalar wave as an ordinary Maxwellian electromagnetic wave. So you just put it in an extremely strong magnetic field, as strong one as you can make in the laboratory, stick a straight wire in there or a coil or any other kind of detector you want to stick, an ordinary detector, leave one end of it hanging open, tie the other end to a resonant circuit that feeds an oscilloscope, and you can look at all the scalar waves you want to see. So when you do that, you'll find that something like the woodpecker is very much more complicated than what you can find with a normal spectrum analyzer or with our normal detectors. In other words, they can put stuff down below the ocean, in the common language I'm using here now, the stuff that our normal detectors don't see. They can put currents, they can put resonant signals, They can put patterns and multiple patterns. The interesting thing about those kind of patterns that you put in that way that we do not see with our normal detectors and we don't know are there, in the human body, there are highly nonlinear detectors that are very precise. Up until about 3-4 years ago, the orthodox scientific view was that the only thing that electromagnetic waves really did to tissue was when they were strong enough to heat it. And if they heated the tissue and hurt it, then that was what damage they did. Simply how much energy was deposited in a cubic centimeter of flesh or something like that was the way they looked at it. Energy deposition. Today, through some very forward-looking scientists who pounded away and done the experiments until they found it and proved it, and it's now been accepted, we now know that a biological system has very, very sharp trigger frequencies in it. And as well pointed out, lo, these many years ago by my good friend Dr. Robert Beck out there in California, I think he's been fully vindicated in the fact that those triggers do exist and they are very precise. The literature now bears out everything Bob was saying quite some time ago.
Well, I hope he'd get on the air with us, but he's still shy.
Okay, well, that's fine. I understand why. He's got good reason. But he's a capital fellow, and he, like I say, a lot of the things that he's been doing years ago, and that a lot of people put a lot of pressure on him because he was doing that, he's being fully vindicated at the present time. Now, the scalar wave, if there's a nonlinear part of the body that has one of those sharp biological triggers, let's say down in a cell, and it's quite nonlinear in there, when in the scalar wave part of it, that is, that's below the ocean, the hidden part, if you have that exact frequency in there, and that's absorbed in the body, and you hit that sharp trigger, you get an effect far beyond the very minuscule amount of energy you might be putting into the body. And so, if you know about those biological triggers, and you know how to hit them, you can hit them from Riga and Gomel or wherever else you're putting the transmission of this kind of energy out. You can hit them in a U.S. target population. You can hit them in us, sitting here in North America.
Are you saying then, with transmitters in the Soviet Union, they're able then to affect the bioenergetics of the human body?
That is correct, and halfway around the world. I'm saying exactly that. And the scalar component of it, the normal, conducting shield, the normal Faraday shield will not work. It won't even slow the scalar wave down because the free electrons don't react to the scalar wave. It goes right through them. It'll only react to something that's nonlinear. You have to build a very nonlinear device to shield against that. You can shield against it, but you can't shield against it the way we normally do shielding. And so the normal kinds of shields that we have don't even slow it down. It goes directly on into the body and hits its target if they, in fact, put that frequency in there. And so that sort of thing can be done to the population or the target population over in, and you can do it real easy in the zone where you interfere the waves and you make them into normal energy waves there. You can add a component which will hit the weaker biological triggers that way. You just hit it with normal energy. Now, the interesting thing about this interference pattern, when you do the interference, the energy which rises that we're forming in the middle rises from the microscopic region. That is, it rises from points in space. It does not come through the space like you would think of a wave going through water. It's as if it arose at each point in the water. So anything in that region has electromagnetic energy forming in it at the smallest point, in the atoms, in the nuclei, if it's made of molecules, the material is, it's in the molecules. And so you can have very, very intense point heating occur, point deposition of energy in an object this way. With that effect, for example, with transmitters in the laboratory putting out even kilowatts of power, very well focused down into those micro points, you can shatter, for example, giant steel bolts or do things like that because you can get severe deposition of energy in very small volumes of material throughout a narrow section of material. And that becomes a very lethal thing when you do that. And so you can get very localized heating. By the way, psychokinesis, when the human being is able to bend or break metal, it's done exactly by the same mechanism. The two cerebral hemispheres of the brain can act as scalar projectors, and they can produce rays or beams or waves which interfere in a local region. And if you're holding a stainless steel bar, a stainless steel fork, and you get one of these bends or breaks in there, that's the way it's being done. And by the way, I have a friend who I don't think wants his name mentioned, so I won't mention him. But I have a friend who's doing some very excellent scientific work in that area. What he's doing is he'll use something like a stainless steel rod. He'll buy two of them, and he'll take to a place where the a person does psychokinetic bending. And he will have one of the rods bent psychokinetically. The other will be retained as a control sample. They will then take both of these samples back to the laboratory and section them. And he will look at the cross-sections of both of them under the electron microscope. The interesting thing is, the normal control rod, you see the grain pattern just like you would see in a normal piece of metal. But in the rod which has been bent or broken, if you will look at that on the electron microscope, you will see the grain structure has been drastically changed at the microscopic level. It looks like you're looking at the surface of the moon. You see intense heating in little puddles and little holes, just like you were looking at the pockmarked surface of the moon. A completely abnormal thing. And by the way, that's a thing you can't fake on your belt buckle either.
Nope, it's
you
there.
You cannot change the grain structure of the metal in that fashion by any sleight-of-hand trick. And some of the people that are doing these are little old ladies in tennis shoes. In fact, they make the best benders.
They really do. And we have one, Greta Woodrue. I think you know Greta.
Yes.
She shrinks the metal.
Yes, indeed. You have other physical effects that let you know that it's not done on the belt buckle or by sleight of hand.
By the way, in about 2 weeks, I'm going to go down and learn how to walk on coals, and I suppose I'm using that left and right hemisphere to do that.
Yes, indeed. Since we're on that subject and since we're talking about scalar interferometry, we may as well cover the mechanism by which that's done. What happens here, I'll have to cover one other effect of this. In that interference pattern, if it were perfect, if you were making perfect scalar waves, in that interference pattern, the energy that's in there would be totally trapped. In other words, a photon could not be radiated out of there. It would be locked as if it were in a bottle. And I've been calling that an energy bottle. Now, in the real world, you don't make a perfect one. So some of the energy escapes and radiates away as photons, as electromagnetic energy radiating away. But if you have a pretty good bottle, anything that comes in that bottle, in its range or in its frequency range, or even close, is going to get locked up in there and isn't going to get out. And so you can do a very amazing thing with that. For example, you can place that kind of a bottle on an object, say like a steel object, and you can be putting in the power now from a distance. Understand, this would be in the laboratory. You would have two beams coming in here, which are crossed where the object is. The energy which you're putting in on the other end of the beams is appearing in the bottle. And so you would have a metal object in here heated white hot. It would be glowing. Because it's not a perfect bottle, you'd be able to see it. You'd be able to take a radiometer and actually measure the temperature to prove how hot it is. You'd have a white hot bottle, white hot metal in that bottle. Now, if you turn the power off on the other end smoothly, then the energy in the bottle, you are creating the energy at a distance. That energy will just simply die right down. And you can turn it off and reach in instantly and pick up an absolutely black object that is not hot at all. It's absolutely cold.
Hmm.
So you can just sort of suck all the energy right out of there. Or you can annihilate the energy is another way to look at it. That has been done. And that, of course, can be quite useful. Now, used as a trap, if you have an energy bottle that's placed, let's say, under the bottom of the feet, under the soles of the feet, or around the skin of the feet, if you have such a bottle in the human body, and that bottle is correctly made so that heat energy, which is electromagnetic energy, entering it gets trapped, then that foot can walk over hot coals and not be burned. And that is exactly the way firewalking is done. Firewalking is demonstrated widely throughout the earth. Many cultures, many people do it. And as you were pointing out, some of the people here in the United States have now taken up showing that you can do firewalking.
Well, there's a group here in Santa Monica that does it. About 80% of the people that go through about a 4.5-hour course, which is a mind-quietening technique more than anything else, not only walk on them, they pick them up in their hands.
That's true, and you'll see them holding them for several seconds, and you'll see the coal glowing red hot. And if you look at the temperature of the coal and you're looking at it in the hand, and the Leidenfrost effect can only be pressed so far, you realize that you couldn't possibly be looking at that. And I'd make your prediction. This effect will grow, and you're going to find more and more people learning to do it.
I'm taking a number of firemen.
For your handling fire, I recommend great care, and I don't recommend anybody trying it by themselves at all.
Well, I'm taking a number of firemen down there. If there's anybody that needs to learn how to handle fire, I think it would be the firemen.
Yes. But it is a real phenomenon. It can be demonstrated, and I think you'll see it being demonstrated from now on, just so that, you know, people will become aware of the fact that this phenomenon is real.
Well, I just got back a couple of weeks ago from Fiji, and I videotaped them walking on those hot coals, hot rocks they were. And they were so hot that they would almost instantly ignite a fresh palm leaf whenever you threw them down on them.
Yes, the phenomenon is very impressive. Now, you know, given an energy bottle created by the two cerebral halves acting as a scalar projector, scalar interferometer, and a transmitter mode, the human being has the capability of doing that. Now, to understand what we're talking about is a human being has the capability to be a beautiful high wire walker and do all the fancy tricks on the high wire. Now, one normally does not develop that ability. That does not mean it's a fake.